Let's begin with prayer. Lord, we joyfully and gratefully acknowledge our dependence upon you for every breath that we draw and for all spiritual good that it comes from you. We recognize our dependence as we study your word, and we pray for the grace and blessing of your Holy Spirit as we approach the borderline cases of ethical conduct. We ask that you will give us wisdom and humility. Enable us to not depart from your word to the right or to the left, but to be aware of our dependence upon you and of the need for your guidance, that we may be truly your representatives in this fallen world. Bless us to that end, we pray, for Jesus' sake. Amen. Now, the topic for today, the resolution of moral conflicts. The situation is this, that in an ethic that poses multiple principles of obligation, such as the Ten Commandments, there is the liability that in certain complex cases, and particularly emergency situations, it may appear that the commandments come into conflict and that you can't obey both. And the classic, and I think that the most difficult, the most pressing example of these is when we have a duty to protect innocent life and also a duty not to communicate falsehood. That's where we feel the tension the greatest. Now, the borderline cases ought to be put in perspective. These emergency situations that folks of sound character, folks that are sensitive to scriptural truth and what proper conduct is, intuitively resolve them in the emergency situation. And some feel that we ought to just leave aside the theoretical aspects of the emergencies and not try to articulate a theory of that, because it is so difficult to get an adequate theory. That maybe we should just concentrate on the cases where they clearly do apply. Gordon Clark took that position. The American evangelical philosopher in our Reformed circles, the Festschrift that was presented to him at the end of his life, one had a critical article and said that he never addressed this issue of the conflict situation. And Clark admitted, well, maybe this is a lacuna, a gap in my thinking, but maybe it's not so serious since the commandments obviously apply most of the time. And I think that there is some sense in that. Since the 60s, there has been an overemphasis on borderline cases with the situation ethics debate. Then this became what ethics was all about. In particular, in courses at very introductory level, the borderline cases were the way of giving instruction in ethics. And you left the impression that, not that they're just difficult answers to hard cases, but that there are no really good answers at all. Unless you have been trained in the areas where the commandments clearly apply, you're really not prepared to deal with the conflict situation. Unless you are trained in the value of truthfulness, unless you're used to telling the truth, unless veracity is one of your personal characteristics, you won't see the dilemma when protection of innocent life is at stake. If you lie every day for convenience, then it's certainly not going to be a problem to lie for some beneficial purpose. So it's only people who have been trained in veracity and truthfulness who, when they, in emergency situation, are faced with this dilemma, is it a dilemma? That was the Holocaust produced many examples of this particular dilemma. I've chosen as an example the villagers of Le Chambon in France. And I'd like to say something about a little bit more about that. These folks were who hid Jews during the Nazi occupation of France. The townspeople were French Huguenots, were French Reformed Church. We call them Huguenots. The people in the outlying countryside were Darbius. We know them as Plymouth Brethren. And it's interesting to think, this is a wonderful cooperative effort between these two Christian groups, both of which were either persecuted or marginalized in terms of their history. You know the Huguenot Church and its persecution, how it was scattered abroad. It remained a tiny minority in France. Part of that history prepared them for identifying with those who are in suffering. The Plymouth Brethren, with their dispensational theology, had a very positive view of Jews. They welcomed the Jews. The opportunity to minister to God's chosen people was for them, you know, a delight. So you have a rather unique situation in terms of that. But the book where this is narrated, it's now in paperback, Lest Innocent Blood Be Shed, is really worth reading. For instruction in ethics, it shows what ordinary Christian people, whose characters are formed, it shows them doing good, really the moral excellent thing, in the crisis situation, and they don't regard it as heroic. It's just what you do. It may be a duty to protect these people, but they don't consider it in terms of duty. They consider it in terms of privilege. They consider it in terms of providing hospitality for folks who are going through tremendous suffering, even under the threat of death. The article that I had you read was written later, before the paperback edition came out. Part of it's incorporated into this paperback edition, but I want to read a part from the original prelude, the original introduction to the book. In the article I gave you, he talks about tears at one point, the tears that are expressed as he discovers moral excellence, he discovers goodness when he's been studying cruelty and is burdened down with that. He at one point is over flooded with tears of joy. Well, it's he describes that incident in more detail in this book. You know that he has been studying cruelty, especially institutional cruelty, for a number of years. On this particular day, he writes, I was reading in an anthology of documents from the Holocaust, and I came across a short article about a little village in the mountains of southern France. As usual, I was reading the pages with an effort at objectivity. I was trying to sort out the forms and elements of cruelty and of resistance to it in much the same way a veterinarian might sort out ill from healthy cattle. About halfway down the third page of the account of this village, I was annoyed by a strange sensation on my cheeks. The story was so simple and so factual that I found it easy to concentrate upon it, not upon my own feelings, and so still following the story and thinking about how some of it fit into the old patterns of persecution, I reached up to my cheek to wipe away a bit of dust, and I felt tears upon my fingertips. Not one or two drops. My whole cheek was wet. Oh, my centennial mind told me, you're losing your grasp on things again. I shut the book and left the college office. When I came home, my operatic Italian wife and my turbulent children, as they have never failed to do, distracted me noisily. I hardly felt the spear that had gone through me, but that night when I lay on my back in bed with my eyes closed, I saw more clearly than ever the images that had made me weep. I saw the two clumsy khaki-colored buses of the Vichy French police pull up into the village square. I saw the police captain facing the pastor of the village and warning him that if he did not give up the names of the Jews they had been sheltering in the village, he and his fellow pastor, as well as the families who had been caring for the Jews, would be arrested. I saw the pastor refuse to give up these people who had been strangers in his village, even at the risk of his own destruction. Then I saw the only Jew the police could find sitting in an otherwise empty bus. Then I saw a 13-year-old boy, the son of the pastor, pass a piece of his precious chocolate through the window to the prisoner, while 20 gendarmes who were guarding the lone prisoner watched. And then I saw the villagers passing their little gifts through the window until there were gifts all around him, most of them food, in those hungry days during the German occupation of France. Lying there in bed, I began to weep again, I thought. Why run away from what is excellent simply because it goes through you like a spear? That night, I decided to try to understand all this. I decided to understand it so that I could hold it more firmly than can one hold a tear or an image. Since I was a student and teacher of ethics, I would use what I had learned about man's standard of ethical excellence to help me understand the blessing, at least for me, of Le Chambon. Those involuntary tears had been an expression of moral praise pressed out of my whole personality like the juice of a grape. But I was not going to make Le Chambon an example of goodness or moral nobility. I was not going to use this story to explain some abstract idea of ethics. I was going to use the words of philosophical ethics only as a means for achieving the goal of understanding. Or to be more accurate, I was going to use the words of ethics to help me understand my deeply felt ethical praise for the deeds of the people of Le Chambon. As we look at the conflict situation through their eyes, I don't want us to miss that that wider context of what is going on there. And all over Europe, there were individuals who responded that way, not thinking of themselves as heroic. It's just doing what God in His providence has placed before you. Yes, there's risk to it, but it's what you do. And the thing at the end of the article that I handed out for you, the last column, one of the reasons institutional cruelty exists and persists is that people believe that individuals can do nothing. I think that's a remarkable statement when you read it in context. And there were individuals also in Germany. There was in the February 11th New York Times magazine of this year an article on Germans in Germany who shelter Jews. They don't get the affirmation that have been given to those in other past places. But a couple of paragraphs from this article. I asked Ursula Meissner, now 77, living in Geneva with her husband, why she had given a fugitive family shelter, even though she didn't know them. Almost shocked, she answered, "What else could I do?" Had she realized the risk she was taking? I didn't think of the risk. It's just something that you do. There has been a flood of psychological studies trying to understand why people risk their lives to save total strangers. But these studies miss the essential point. Ursula Meissner's response was no different from that of hundreds of other rescuers acting in other countries and under other circumstances. They weren't unaware of the dangers, but they thought first of the needs of those in danger. Now, what that it proposed in terms of, and the way I introduced this in for our topic is, when you in order to protect the Jews, they had to deceive the authorities. And one of the first things that they did was to counterfeit ration books. You could not survive. If you were going to protect Jews under those circumstances, it was not just what you would say when the police came to the door, "Are you hiding any Jews? Are there any Jews here?" You have to develop a whole system of deceit, beginning with the counterfeit ration cards. And the pastor's wife, when she looks at those ration cards, she's depressed. And because of a life of veracity, a life of openness, a life of non-deceit. But she says, what could we do? The Jews were running all over. We had to help them. We had to help them quickly. And unfortunately, we had to lie. Now, that is the emergency situation. Either conceal or expose them to harm. Our question is, were the falsehoods justifiable under the circumstances? And if so, on what grounds? And it's with some trepidation that I approach this topic, but there are cases of conscience, some kind of resolution, one way or the other. If we can reduce the level of conflicts, if we can reduce or limit the amount of uncertainty for the sake of conscience and system, even though we may not be able to totally explain what we intuitively know is the right way, our inability to articulate adequately a reason for these circumstances in the emergency situation doesn't mean that no absolutes exist. It only means that they're harder to define than we originally thought. So I think that hard cases need to be kept in perspective. Hard cases test the basic postulates of an ethical system, and different methods of resolution reveal different conceptions of morality. It's the way you go about resolving these that test your system, and it's important to understand a method of dealing with these things that doesn't undermine the application of the commandments in the ordinary circumstances of life. If the way you handle the hard cases introduces a principle that undermines the ordinary cases, then you defeat the whole purpose. And so we're going to look at methods to see what method we can propose that can handle the hard cases, bring peace of conscience in the hard situations without opening the door to all kinds of immorality and undermining the clear application of the commandments otherwise. Now, in the book, I make a point of saying that when we talk about the resolution of moral conflicts, we're excluding two types. We're not talking here about the internal conflict we feel when duty is difficult, when doing right entails personal sacrifice or suffering wrong. If the dilemma is to sin or to suffer, then there's no dilemma in terms of what we ought to do. We ought to accept suffering rather than sin. But what we need in those cases is the courage to do the right thing, not a resolution of some theoretical contest. No theoretical issue there, though there is an existential one. Resolution in that case requires moral courage, not more knowledge, not more theoretical knowledge. Also, not at issue are choices that have to be made because of limitations of time and resources. We can't do everything all the time, and so we have to set priorities. Sometimes we have a conflict between duty to family, duty to church, duty to business. We perceive that as a conflict, but that's not the doesn't demand of us breaking one commandment in order to obey another. It means that we have to discern how to balance the fulfillment of all of these responsibilities. So what we're talking about is where there is an issue that appears to set before us the breaking of one commandment in order to carry out another one. The idea is that the commandments come into conflict. Now, I think I've got about five different methodologies of dealing with these. First is consequentialism. Consequentialism, the supreme principle, this quote is in the, this proposition is in the book, the supreme principle of a consequentialist theory of ethic is that an act is right if it is intended to produce a greater balance of good over evil than any available alternative. An act is right if it is intended to produce a greater balance of good over evil than any available alternative. In other words, acts are right, are judged to be right solely, please underline that, solely in terms of the good consequences that are expected or are intended. Now, this is a common view in humanistic ethics. For example, Corliss, just to give you some illustrative material, Corliss Lamont, in his book, The Philosophy of Humanism, repented many times, for humanism, no human acts are good or bad in and of themselves. Whether an act is good or bad is to be judged by its consequences. that couldn't be more clear. No human acts are good or bad in and of themselves. Whether an act is good or bad is to be judged by its consequences. And Paul Kurtz, that we've been introduced you to before in his book, The Fullness of Life, moral principles are not absolute. The decision must always be guided by considering the long-range consequences. Now, we need to be clear that a plausible theory of ethics, for any ethical theory to be plausible, goodness or badness of expected consequences are at least one source of important moral reasons. The question is whether that's the only standard for what is right. Okay? We're not saying that a regard for foreseeable consequences is ruled out. That's one feature of moral action that must be taken into account. The question here is not whether expected consequences or intended good consequences are a part of ethics. It's whether that's the only principle. And for utilitarianism, as it's also called, in Roman Catholic theology, it's called proportionalism. In Protestant circles, it's called situation ethics. In all of these, I've lumped these together as consequentialist, not just myself, but this is a standard classification. Whatever particular form in terms of philosophical or religious ethics it takes, the idea is that what is right is determined solely by its consequences for the individual and society, or as Paul Kurtz puts it, its long-range consequences. Now, the form in which this is most familiar to us is in situation ethics of Joseph Fletcher. In Fletcher's view, there is only one biblical absolute, the law of love, so that act responsibly in love is the single ethical command. And apart from this, there are no unbreakable rules. So there's only one absolute, act responsibly in love. Now, in a sense, we can agree that that is the summary absolute, act responsibly in love. But the question is whether there are other absolutes that in which love is expressed, whether responsibly means to embody the principles that are expressed in absolutes in addition to the summary of the law. Everything turns on whether love to be responsible must be embodied in actions that conform to the universal moral norms. And I think that it's hard to live with this theory. By the way, I note this in the book, but insert this now. When Fletcher first identified his situation ethics, the absolute principle, with agape, the Christian view of love. But when he was pressed on that, what do you mean by love? Then it became clear that it was utilitarianism. Love, agape, was equated with utility. And that clarified the position for a lot of people, because then it put Fletcher's ethics in a wider context of utilitarianism, for which there has been a growing literature of criticism since it was introduced. But it's so hard to live without introducing an absolute at some point that even Fletcher at one point wrote, "No unwanted or an unintended baby should ever be born." Now, that's just about as absolute as you can get. No unwanted and unintended baby should ever be born. So in spite of the idea that there's only one absolute, it's hard to live that way without thinking that there are other principles. Of course, we reject that as a principle. We should say that no baby born or unborn should be unwanted. That would be the proper way of putting that into its context. Now, there are four problems with the... let me give you five objections to consequentialism. These are not in the book that I have, the way I put them here. But let me give you these five objections to consequentialism, also known as utilitarianism, also known as situation ethics. Number one, it wrongly sets persons against rules. A lot of the appeal of situation ethics is that rules seem so impersonal and love seems so personal. But it leaves aside the fact that rules, such as the Ten Commandments, at least the second table, define the rights and responsibilities of persons. Okay, it's wrong to set persons against rules. The rules are there for the protection and guidance of persons. You shall not kill as a significant personal application or relevance. It's there to protect persons, human lives, from wanton destruction. So it's wrong to, situation ethics wrongly sets persons against rules. Secondly, it depends upon an impossible calculation of consequences. Your judgment, as Paul Kurtz says, is long-range consequences. In other words, if the principle is the greater balance of good over evil, you have to know a lot more than just what happens immediately. You have to know the effects of that on other actions, other events, and so on. Really, properly stated, it would be in the universe as a whole, a greater balance of good over evil in the universe as a whole. Who can know that? So it depends on an impossible calculation of consequences, consequences, especially long-range consequences, are unpredictable with certainty, and so there is an element of uncertainty in the principle itself. Wrongly sets persons against rules depends upon an impossible calculation of consequences. Thirdly, it reduces to subjectivism. It is not subject to criticism because it lacks an intrinsic standard of judgment. It's not subject to criticism because it lacks an intrinsic standard of judgment. It's what the individual judges will be for the greater balance of good over evil. And if an individual makes that judgment, they're just as to act responsibly in love, and the individual determines what is responsible in terms of balance of good over evil, there's no way to criticize that. Not even those who put Christ to death, if they thought that that was for a greater good. You know, Caiaphas' rationale, it's expedient that one man die, that the whole people perish not. Ironically, what he said was true, but not in the sense that he intended it. It was, what he says is, an innocent man... We can't make a case against him, but it's for the sake of the protection of the people, it's expedient that an innocent man be put to death, that a greater good, the protection of the others, be there. Without an objective principle of justice, that it is open to all kinds of obvious injustice. Gordon Clark says, and he's certainly right, the greatest good for the greatest number is a principle for tyrants. And totalitarian governments are always using that as their argumentation. For the sake of an ideology, a greater long-range good, people can be put to death. And that is, worked itself out. Hitler, Stalin, Mao, just to name three, ideological consequentialist arguments have produced a terrible harvest of shame in terms of persons who were killed in this century. It is the bloodiest century. And I think we should remind ourselves that Nazism has slain its millions, but communism has slain its tens of millions. There is a book that's caused quite a stir in France. It's now been translated into English, Harvard University Press, 1999, that documents the atrocities of communism. The title of the book is The Black Book of Communism. I don't particularly like that title, but the documentation of the horrendous numbers of death through ideologically imposed famine in both Ukraine and China, it's horrific. Now, Nazism has a special evil because of its genocidal implications and its anti-Semitism, but in terms of quantitative murderous acts justified in terms of an ideology that was supposed to bring in a greater good, communism has the figures. Number four, situations are not so unique as to eliminate classification. Situations are not so unique as to eliminate classification. The idea was, in situation ethics, that every situation is unique, and we have to decide in the situation what is going to be for the greater good. Well, every situation is unique, but there are certain features that they have in common, and so we can classify them. We can then see where a particular circumstance fit that description. For example, in the case of terminal decision-making at times of terminal illness, each situation has to be judged in the light of what the facts are in that situation. You have to take into account the facts and whether treatment is going to do the patient any good, whether non-treatment is the appropriate care. So that depends upon the facts. But you can classify the cases, as we will do as we get into that, in terms of what constitutes a rationale for non-intervention under those circumstances. And so every situation has its own particular facts that be taken into account. But after those facts are discerned, they fit into certain classes of cases. And we distinguish between euthanasia and non-intervention of medical treatment. And sometimes non-intervention is culpable, and sometimes it is the right thing to do. We have criteria that enable us to judge. Then the fifth point is, in consequentialism, there is the tendency toward self-serving antinomianism. The tendency toward self-serving antinomianism is inevitable in a fallen humanity. Now, this is not only a principle for tyrants, this is a principle for self-justification. The tendency toward self-serving antinomianism is inevitable in a fallen humanity. What I mean by that is if there are no principles of justice that apply universally, if it's all situational and relative to the situation, then I will take advantage, as a sinner, I will take advantage of that and use it in a self-serving way. I'll give you two examples. To claim falsehood in the national interest, that's sometimes done, but it's sometimes done in self-interest. When you examine it, the national interest is not at stake, the political interest is at stake. To claim a falsehood for the protection of the family is, in reality, often turns out to be for self-protection. You see how, if there's no universal rule that sets the standard, then what's in one's personal interest is often clouded under in what's in some wider interest. It's in consequences. That's almost inevitable in terms of a fallen humanity, that once you introduce a principle that only consequences count, that it will be used in a self-serving way. At least I think that proposition holds. Now, this is one of the great dividing lines in ethics in this country. Consequentialism, in effect, resolves moral conflicts by removing universal principles, reducing everything to the one principle of good consequences. Then there are no conflicts, okay? If you only have a single rule that's consequences for good, the greater balance of good over evil, you remove moral conflicts by removing traditional morality in terms of universal principles of right and wrong. We get this in our, when we come to specific cases, we'll see how this has affected so much of our society. In the case of the anencephalic child that was born in Florida, of which the parents wanted to, since the child was soon going to die, the parents wanted to donate her, to take her body parts while they were still usable, and really to put her to death in order to that those parts might be used for some others. Well, there's a quote from the newspaper. One demonstrator, this was a 4 or 5 years ago now, but the kind of thinking goes on. One demonstrator said, "Baby Teresa was a gift from God. She was not created by God for spare parts." Another, the baby's maternal grandmother saw it differently. Taking one and helping 2, 3, 5, that's pro-life. The issue is, you know, may you take one life in order to help 2, 3, 5? It sounds good. Don't we want to do good consequences? Well, good consequences are something we should aim at, provided there's no injustice, which in this case would be discrimination against the handicapped, killing an anencephalic baby in order to help someone else. If you introduce the principle that it's all right to kill in order that good may come, you have undermined a principle of justice, and it opens to all sorts of obvious injustice. Okay, any question about consequentialism? Okay, evangelicals have pretty much critiqued consequentialism and rejected that. The next options are all held by evangelicals in one form or another. I think that when consequentialism appeared on the scene, we weren't very well prepared for it. The ethics text that had been written up until the 60s in evangelical circles didn't address the hard cases. And I think that we were caught off guard in that respect. And various proposals have been adopted by evangelicals. One is goes by the name of tragic morality, or to posit the idea of the tragic moral choice. We live in a fallen world, the theory says, and in such a world as this, we may be faced with a choice between alternatives, both of which conflict with some absolute principle of duty. So, tragic moral choice posits absolutes, unlike consequentialism that has only one absolute. Tragic morality says, yes, there are multiple absolutes, and they do sometimes, because we live in a fallen world, come into conflict with each other. And when they do, then we should choose the lesser of two evils, but we need to confess our sin for having done the evil, even though we were caught and we had to do evil in one, either the lesser or the greater. It was the best thing to do under the circumstances, but you're still held guilty for that. And there are some prominent evangelicals who have taken this position. J.I. Packer, not to be dismissed, has taken that position. that the absolutes come into conflict, and we should do the right thing and do the lesser evil, but even so, we are held guilty for that. Now, I have a problem with this, even though, a person such as the stature of J.I. Packer take that position. And I think that what's going on here is the respect for, let's say, saving life and telling truth, both of those are equally valid in terms of principle, universal principles of duty, intuitively recognizing in such a case as you have been providing refuge for Jews under the Holocaust, that you would provide the refuge even if it meant telling falsehoods, and yet still feeling that that has broken an absolute principle of duty. Even though it's the right thing to do, it's wrong. But it's not as wrong as letting them go. But it's still wrong, and so your conscience is not perfectly free. I think that there's some problems with this, though. I think it's too easy a way out. I mean, not that it's easy, but it ought to be more articulated if we're going to take that as a position. After all, if the absolute is to tell truth, then we may not, that's something we have to take up with God, and you need at least not. I've never seen a defense of why telling the truth or telling falsehood is a lesser sin than allowing somebody else to take another person's life. It ought at least be articulated. But here's my problem: to choose the lesser of two evils, evil is ambiguous. If it's physical evil that we're talking about, things are physically less than ideal, then that's a different thing. If you've got, it's bad not to have both arms, but if one of your arms is got gangrene, then you better amputate the arm in order to preserve your life. Okay? And that your purpose is not to maim. Your purpose is to heal. Ordinarily, if it weren't for the circumstance of the gangrene, cutting off somebody's arm would be maiming that person. But you accept the lesser evil, physical evil, of going through life with one arm, against the greater evil of dying as a consequence of the gangrene. Now, what we're talking about here is choosing between two absolute things that God has commanded. We ought to remind ourselves that we're talking about the lesser of two sins. And then it becomes harder, theoretically, to justify this, because we're saying that God has placed us in a situation in which we're going to have to sin, and we should choose we're going to choose the lesser sin, but we're still responsible for confessing our sin. You see, we call this the tragic moral choice because it derives from Greek tragedy. The idea in Greek tragedy is sometimes in that polytheistic culture, you got gods giving you different commands, and you're faced with a choice of if you obey one god, you disobey the other god. And you've got a tragic moral choice. So you choose the lesser evil. That is, you choose to disobey the God that you can think can do the less evil to you. You're damned if you do and damned if you don't. You choose to disobey the God that can do the least damage, okay? But in a world where there is only one lawgiver and judge, this is incoherent. It's God who gives the commands, and moreover, it is God who controls the providence in which he has placed us. I think that we can say that God will not put us in a position where it's necessary for us to sin. It's his law. The answer comes back, well, in an unfallen world, the commandments would not come into conflict. That's certainly true. However, the commandments are given to us in a fallen world. The commandments are for our guidance. We need them because we live in a fallen world. So I think that this is not the way to go. Making sin necessary under some tragic circumstances falls short of the biblical ideal. And I have some sympathy with what people are doing here. They feel that they can't resolve the problem. They still feel guilty for that. And they do the right thing even though they feel guilty, and they rely on God's forgiveness. So I want to respect that. Subjectively, they haven't resolved the problem, but intuitively, they do the right thing. But I think if we can relieve consciences, it's our obligation to do so. And this this category of seems to me to involve some difficulty in requiring remorse for having done the only right thing under the circumstances. And there's a further problem that I've noticed, that once you adopt this for emergency circumstances, you've introduced a principle into your ethic that begins to multiply in its application. And so you know that divorce is wrong, but you also know it's good to live a fulfilled life. And which is the lesser of two evils, to not have a fulfilled life or to get a divorce? The argument of the lesser two evils is quite frequent when it comes to the issue of divorce. Without working, it short circuits the process of working through the moral principles and their application. And adopted for emergency circumstances, it tends to multiply to other areas as well. If you adopt as a matter of resolution to choose the lesser of two evils, it's going to eat up your ethics. Just like consequentialism eats it up, you know, until virtually anything can be done. So the lesser of two evils will allow you to do virtually anything as long as you feel half guilty about it. That I see is the problem. Now, I want to make a distinction. This isn't in the book. But I think that we need sometimes the principle of the lesser evil that we've been talking about here ought not to be confused with tolerating evil in order to promote a greater good. What we've been talking about so far is doing evil that good may come, doing a little evil and that a lot of good may come. I think we're forbidden by Scripture to do evil that good may come. And so if God has absolutely forbidden falsehood, then we can't tell falsehood. He will not allow you to be tempted above what you're able, but He will make a way of escape that you may be able to bear it. I think that although that refers to something different, it is relevant to the idea that God's providence controls all events. And God will not place us, will He? I think it is incoherent to think that God, who controls all events, will place us in a situation in which we have to sin. And that's making sin inevitable. I don't think we can say that sin is inevitable, because that would make God the author of sin through arranging the circumstances in which it's inescapable. It's inevitable that we sin. I think so. I think that there is, but I would say we may not be able to articulate it as well as we would like to, but I think that in principle, there is a resolution. In principle, there is a resolution. This, I think, doesn't give a resolution. It remains with a problem because it hasn't resolved it. It's only said, let's do the lesser evil. But the evil is still there. And in a way, you're doing evil that good may come. And you're saying that God's absolutes come into conflict. Well, it's God who commands. I think we need to examine the absolutes and see what they really are before we... I take it as an a priori that what God commands will never be contradictory. God is not, you know, a contradictory God. He won't command us in things that conflict with His commands. I think we can rely on the fact that there is some resolution. I don't think consequentialism, just act in love, does it, because that erodes all the things. But I don't think this does it. This does it either because of that. Now, I was trying to distinguish this from another thing. This idea refers to doing evil that good may come. I want to distinguish that from tolerating evil in order to promote a greater good. It is sometimes permissible to tolerate evil, but never permissible to choose evil. Now, I think that you have that in the Old Testament with respect to arbitrary divorce. God himself tolerated evil in order that women may have protection in that kind of society. We may also tolerate evil, but that's different from choosing evil. This came up at the time that Dr. Koop was Surgeon General, in which he had a universal mailing to every American household that had an address with respect to AIDS. And the self-protection from AIDS, he advocated the use of condoms. Many folks objected to that on the grounds that was tolerating practices which were themselves evil. But Koop's argument was, I'm the public health is my responsibility, and there's some things in out of concern for public health that you allow and tolerate and make available information to people of how to protect themselves in order for there to be public health. There's some things that we tolerate that we do not approve, but we tolerate them for the sake of a greater good. So condom distribution would be one of those issues. We can take a look at, we're going to talk about, when we get to sexual ethics, we'll take another look at that. But that is an example of sometimes the difference between choosing evil and tolerating evil. We may never choose evil that a greater good may come, but sometimes we may have to tolerate certain things that are evil for the sake of public health or whatever. Okay? Any other questions on this, on tragic morality? The question is, how much is this way of thinking affected our society that we choose to do evil that good may come? And I'm not clear about that. This is more operative in evangelical circles because we can't resolve the conflict. Society as a whole tends to be utilitarian or consequentialism. But when you examine that, it leaves minorities with little protection. And you need a principle of justice. It's for the sake of minorities that you must balance your utilitarianism with a principle of justice. You can't just, for the good of society, deny folks their rights. You must give everybody their rights. Utilitarian. That's the governing philosophy. I would say that's the dominant philosophy in American culture. Some form of utilitarianism. And so, well, I didn't get to watch it last night. I videotaped it to watch it later. But 2020 had a program on the selling of fetal body parts, using fetal body parts for profits. And I haven't viewed that yet, but that's the idea that there's a greater good here, and without thinking about what we're saying about the value of human life when we begin to sell fetal body parts and the issue that does. That compounds the motivation in giving and having an abortion. If a person feels that some good will come from it, they're more likely to have the abortion for altruistic motives. At least somebody will benefit from this baby that I can't carry. But you see how that doing evil that good may come, you know, it sort of balances it out. Yes, I think so. I think that it is. I think that that's right. I think that helps with the decision. If you can, you know, there's this deep-seated feeling that it's not right. In spite of all that we say about choice, there's that questionable aspect, that doubtful aspect. To get people over that hump, this works in such a way as to, if they can think of a beneficent purpose, then it helps them. It's not just a total wipeout. It doesn't seem to be so selfish a choice if someone else benefits. That's why consequentialism is so dominant in our society. If I can project good consequences, but you see, good consequences need to be balanced by a principle of justice so that the rights of all, even infants, even unborn infants, are protected. I was thinking of something else. I know what it is. I think as this lesser of two evils is applied to divorce, it's also applied to the question of abortion. That's also one way of dealing without really resolving the ethical issue there. It short circuits the process of moral reasoning. Yes. Yeah, the question is whether tolerating evil, are we in some way culpable of that? It depends on the circumstances. That there are some evils that we ought not to tolerate, and we try to remove them from the society in which we live. Clearly, we're not talking about all tolerating evil. Sometimes it is culpable to tolerate evil. But there's some evils that in order to try to stop them, we create a greater evil as a result. For example, if one believes that contraception is wrong, to try to impose that upon a society can lead to worse problems than allowing folks to have access to contraception, even though you believe that it is wrong. So you tolerate what you consider to be an evil in order to prevent a greater evil that might come about. Now, that's an example that may or may not be, you know, the right way to approach that. But that would be an example of tolerating an evil, choosing in that, tolerating a lesser evil. The greater evil being the social chaos and the threat of abortion the temptation to abortion in the absence of contraception. Now, that's the greater evil in that case. If you restrict contraception, then you tempt women to have abortions. So you tolerate, if you're opposed to contraception, you tolerate contraception to prevent a greater evil. That would be an example, but obviously not all evils we can tolerate, and we ought to oppose them. We ought to, oppose racial discrimination, for example. That's not something you can tolerate. Yes, sir. Yeah, Bill. Yeah, good question. Is the argument I just gave consequentialist in nature? Remember, I'm saying that any ethical theory that's plausible have to have in good consequences as one component of it. It's not that that's the whole of ethics. We're not anti-consequentialists. We are against making consequences the sole criterion of what is right. But we do have to consider good consequences. It's obvious in the Bible. This simple example, if what you eat causes your brother to stumble, then you ought not to eat it. That has bad consequences. I mean, that's a simple idea of a consequential law. You've got to take that into account. Take into account the effects that your actions have on others, even though intrinsically there's nothing wrong. So it's not that we're opposed to consequences. We have to balance them with the principle of justice. I'm saying there's no sin in tolerating contraception with the goal of the greater good of preventing more abortions. Okay? Any other questions? Okay, this is tough stuff. And but I think it's important for